Now, shall we begin?
Woods was convicted two different times and sentenced to life in prison without parole.
At the time, with the evidence that we had, with the science that we had at the time, the investigators did what they thought was correct, and the prosecution did as well.
Woods was released from prison in September, her conviction vacated after new evidence came forward. Rodney Hellbauer's DNA was found on a cigarette butt from the crime scene, and it also matched forensics evidence from two of the Gypsy Hill murders. He awaits trial in San Mateo County, and Woods will not be prosecuted again.
Today it's wonderful. I wish it had happened a long time ago, but I don't think it could have. So today it's terrific.
Woods lives with her brother and sister-in-law in Southern California, where she still struggles with mental illness. And she's also adjusting to a world much different than the 1970s.
She didn't know how to use a cell phone. She knows how now. She didn't know how to use a telephone or television remote control. She knows how to do that. I don't think she's tackled a computer yet. She hasn't driven in 35 years, and I don't think that anybody's going to let her try just yet.
Now, the DA says the Mitchell family has been very understanding of what's become of this case. Hellbauer is the suspect in Michelle's murder, but he has not been arrested or charged in Washoe County yet. Covering the big story live in the newsroom, Paul Nelson, Channel 2 News.
It's worth beginning, I suppose, with Nietzsche's aphorism that everything the state says is a lie and everything that it claims to have is stolen. One of the most pernicious of the multifarious lies told by the state is that it maintains something called a justice system. This so-called justice system traffics in stolen lives. That's because the so-called justice system is designed to produce convictions rather than to achieve actual justice, which requires restitution for victims of crimes that were committed against person or property. I've pointed this out before, it bears repeating. The foundational flaw in this system is that it defines the state, this evil non-entity, if you will, not the injured individual, the tangible, palpable individual who has been harmed by a criminal act, as the victim in a criminal trial. This isn't true in the civil court system. In the civil court system, the individual is named as a plaintiff. That doesn't happen now in the criminal system. We might as well call it a criminal system as opposed to a criminal justice system, which is maintained in the name of the state. And what this means, inescapably, is that the trial becomes an exercise in vindicating the supposed authority of the state, enhancing whatever prestige it possesses, reinforcing its claims to legitimacy, such as they are, and enriching, most importantly, the constituencies that profit from the actions taken in its name. We have to understand as well that all of these objectives can be achieved by convicting an individual who has not committed an actual criminal offense against a real victim. And this helps explain why the vast majority of those arrested, prosecuted, and imprisoned in the American Soyuz are suspected of politically defined offenses rather than actual crimes. And obviously, the state-imposed punishment for victimless acts that are treated as if they were real crimes, that punishment can't involve restitution because there is no actual victim. I pointed this out before, and I will rehearse these statistics once again. According to the FBI, in 2013, police in the United States made 11,302,102 arrests, fewer than 500,000, that would be 480,360, were for crimes of violence. Arrests for property crimes tallied 1,559,284. They were more than doubled by arrests for drug-related offenses if we include DUIs, driving under the influence, within that total. Just as importantly, all of the objectives pursued within the state's so-called justice system can be achieved through the wrongful conviction of someone who didn't commit an actual crime. That result leaves victims of actual crimes bereft of of restitution, and it also compounds the offense that they suffered by stealing the freedom and, in many instances, the life from an innocent defendant. This, however, does satisfy the needs of the only parties who matter within this system, which are the police and prosecutors and judges and penal officials, whose careers can only be enhanced by obtaining convictions, and who in all but the rarest of circumstances cannot be held personally liable for convicting the innocent. On a couple of previous occasions, I've talked about Lex Talanis, which is the Old Testament Law of Moses standard of justice and proportionality. It's often described as a manifestation of tribal severity untempered by justice. There is a core principle within that system, and I am profoundly grateful that we do not live under the Mosaic Law. There is a core principle here that, abstracted from the biblical context, is indispensable to actual justice, and that is the principle of proportionality and the principle of accountability. And under that system, prosecutors or judges or accusers who are guilty of wrongful convictions would be required to serve the same sentence they seek to inflict on the innocent. This means that they would have skin in the game, so to speak, and that would inspire them to take much greater care in building and presenting criminal cases. If we had, in the context of the current system, a degree of rationality and it functioned as it's advertised, investigators, prosecutors, and judges would be just as zealous, if not more zealous, to exonerate those who have been wrongfully convicted as they are to put them in prison. There are a handful of prosecutors who have displayed that type of diligence. There was one, for instance, in Dallas County, who actually opened up a dead case file and began to reevaluate many of the prior convictions in order to determine who had been sent to prison unjustly by his predecessors. I think he might be unique, actually, in terms of trying to achieve actual justice in that respect. And he's not altogether commendable. He's a prosecutor. What do you expect? As things stand, however, the system convicts in haste and exonerates at leisure, and often there's a deliberate effort to run out the clock by prolonging post-conviction relief until wrongfully convicted individuals are either dead or too old to cause much trouble. Within just the last couple of days, we've seen a lawsuit filed by somebody who met that description. She spent 35 years in prison for a murder that took place in 1976. She was exonerated just recently, within the last 3 years, by DNA evidence, and she has sued officials in Nevada and Louisiana, making a very good case that she has suffered civil rights violations and malicious prosecution. Her name is Kathy Woods. She's 66 years old. Her attorneys say she was deprived of almost her entire adult life based on a confession authorities got while questioning her without a lawyer at a psychiatric hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana. She was an extremely vulnerable person at that time and today, Elizabeth Wang, one of Woods' lawyers, said Tuesday. That would have been this last Tuesday. Anyone who sees her would see what 35 years in prison did to her. Woods, who also used the name Anita Carter, was freed in September 2014 and cleared last year in the stabbing death of 19-year-old Michelle Mitchell near the University of Nevada in Reno. A National Registry of Exonerations database lists Woods as the longest ever wrongfully incarcerated woman in U.S. history, 35 years she spent in prison. Officials say DNA linked an Oregon prisoner, Rodney Halbauer, to the stabbing, which drew intense media attention during the 3 years it went unsolved. In other words, they had somebody in the system who was likely to have been the perpetrator in this crime, and yet for the sake of convenience and expediency, they found a psychologically infirm woman and extorted a confession out of her in order to obtain a conviction. This kind of thing happens much more frequently than most people would assume, even those who are blessed with a healthy cynicism about how the system operates. I would go so far as to say that that happens constantly. It's most likely going on somewhere in the United States right now. And when I return, I will revisit a particularly egregious example of this variety of deliberate injustice that has been perpetrated by the state of Idaho, in which there's very compelling evidence that two innocent men have been imprisoned for the crimes of a serial killer and serial rapist who, for some reason that defies understanding, enjoyed the protection of the state of Idaho. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio. Stand by for more sedition after this.
Retired Seattle judge Mike Heavey has been reviewing this case for 2 years. He works for free. He studies cases that he considers wrongful convictions. He says the public must push for the TAP conviction to be overturned. The county public defender agrees. And interestingly, not only was TAP's mother on hand to answer questions tonight, but the murder victim's mother, too, thinks TAP has been wrongly convicted.
There's not one speck of evidence on Angie. That belongs to Chris Tapp. It belongs to one individual. And that individual has never been found.
You know, he spent 19 years already of his life in there, and he should have never been there in the first place.
At the end of the day, Chris Tapp is an innocent man who's in prison. And justice requires that he be released.
What we see in this clip is a continuation of what we see throughout these recordings. The police officer is using psychological coercive tools to try to get a confession. When he says, "You've got to save your life," that's completely inappropriate.
Retired Seattle judge Mike Heavey has been reviewing this case for 2 years. He works for free. He studies cases that he considers wrongful convictions. He says the public must push for the TAP conviction to be overturned. The county public defender agrees. And interestingly, not only was TAP's mother on hand to answer questions tonight, but the murder victim's mother, too, thinks TAP has been wrongly convicted.
When innocent people are punished in cases involving crimes of violence, a violent criminal is often allowed to remain free to harm other innocent people. This is undeniably what happened with respect to the conviction of Idaho Falls resident Christopher Conley Tapp. I've devoted more than one podcast to this story and written a very lengthy article earlier this year about it, but I will rehearse the critical facts of that story at this point because there are other aspects of the story which have recently come to my attention that I will share with you anon. Angie Dodge was murdered in her Idaho Falls apartment on or about June 13th of 1996. The perpetrator entered the apartment without forcing access to it, and he was strong enough to overcome the determined resistance of an athletic woman who was 6 feet tall and weighed roughly 180 pounds. And the victim's body displayed defensive wounds, which suggests that she did not submit without putting up a fight. There was semen deposited on the victim's upper torso, but a postmortem determined that she had not been raped. That's an important point as we examine the process that was used to railroad Christopher Tapp into a confession. The crime scene evidence made it clear that this heinous act was carried out by a lone perpetrator. That's also important for the purpose of discussing the framing of Christopher Tapp. The physical evidence, meaning the DNA extracted from the semen, excludes Christopher Tapp as a legitimate suspect. He has been imprisoned for more than 19 years, which is nearly half of his life, for a murder that he patently did not commit after being forced to confess through a month-long ordeal of protracted interrogation involving threats and psychological duress that has been characterized by experts in interrogation as a form of torture. The actual interrogation itself took place over the course of 9 days, a period during which he was effectively or actually a captive of the Idaho Falls Police Department. The nonprofit activist organization called Judges for Justice, which is a group of retired judges and criminal investigators, has concluded that this was a false confession and a wrongful conviction. That group has released a video documentary, which is available on YouTube, in which they analyzed the methods that were used by Idaho Falls Police Detective Jared Furman. Full disclosure, he might be a distant relative of mine on my mother's side of the family. Jared Furman and his colleagues employed coercive and deceptive methods to suborn Tapp into ratifying false accusations against a friend. First of all, they were seeking to turn him into a witness against somebody who was the initial suspect in the case. Then they used the same methods to extract from him a false confession of the murder. That video is somber in tone and utterly devoid of sensationalism. And that documentary evidence deserves at least as much attention as has been given to the wonderful Netflix investigative series entitled Making a Murderer. Tapp did live in the same neighborhood as the victim, and he considered her to be a friend. He also knew Ben Hobbs, who was the Idaho Falls resident selected by the Idaho Falls Police Department as a suspect after he was arrested in Ely, Nevada, for raping a woman at knife point. When he was brought in for questioning in the investigation of his friend Ben Hobbs, he was told that he was being treated as a witness against his friend. However, a detailed critique of his questioning by Judges for Justice investigator Greg McCrary, who is a former FBI supervisory agent, points out that Detective Furman and his associates treated him, meaning Tapp, as a suspect from the very beginning of the case. Tapp was the subject of 9 interrogations over 3.5 weeks for over 20 hours, McCrary summarizes. Detectives refused to accept Tapp's repeated denials of involvement, arresting and jailing him when he did not implicate Hobbs, and then releasing him when he did so. This could be considered a form of operant conditioning. The method that was used to interrogate Tapp is commonly called the Reed technique, and it has been frequently criticized for its use of manipulating suspects into false confessions. Despite this, Joseph Buckley, who is the president of Johnny Reed and Associates, a consulting firm that advises police departments with respect to interrogations, he emphasizes that interrogators taught to use his method are counseled that they should not try to talk a suspect into believing that they committed the crime. Yet this is precisely what the IFPD's investigators did under the direction of Detective Furman, who went on to become the mayor of Idaho Falls, interestingly enough. McCrary points out that Furman and his comrades ran the table of the methods that are expressly prohibited by the people who put the Reed technique together, such as threatening inevitable consequences. That is perhaps their most egregious offense in this case. Making a promise of leniency in return for the confession, denying a subject their rights, and conducting an excessively long interrogation, which is a technique that was refined and perfected by the Soviet KGB in its various incarnations and by that organization's epigenes in places like North Korea and in Cuba. The only evidence against Tapp is the confession that he has since recanted. There is an abundance of physical evidence that was deposited by the killer at the scene, including semen, hair, fingerprints, and skin cells. None of it offers a match to Tapp, who once again has spent nearly 20 years behind bars for this murder. Carol Dodge, the mother of the murder victim, has spent decades trying to learn the truth about what happened to her daughter and has become one of Christopher Tapp's most outspoken advocates on the basis of the evidence. She initially hated him for reasons that one would understand. She believed that he had sexually assaulted and murdered her 18-year-old daughter. How could she not hate him? After immersing herself in the evidence with a zeal and diligence that say very commendable things about her and which were manifestly not present in the official investigation of this case, she came to the conclusion that the wrong man had been convicted for this offense and that the killer had been left at large. On her own initiative and at her own expense, she has done this. She has collected and reviewed scores of hours of video-recorded interrogations, which must have been nearly as torturous for her as it was for Christopher Tapp. And she has been convinced, on the basis of the evidence, that Tapp was innocent. I am at the mercy of the city of Idaho Falls and the prosecution to find the one and only killer of my daughter, she despairingly observes. They need to do their job. Tapp became entangled in this investigation not only because he was a friend of Ben Hobbs, the man originally suspected of the murder, but also because he was known to the lead investigator, Detective Furman. Before his promotion to detective, Furman had been a resource officer and DARE instructor at Idaho Falls High School, where he had become acquainted with his future victim. And I will be back in just a minute.
This is the most contaminated and one of the most coerced confessions I've seen in almost 20 years of doing this work. We'll go to bat for you. We're in your corner. If you just involve yourself a little bit in the crime, we think you'll be okay. Was involved in Brandon's story.
Things he also found in the Tapp case.
Almost the exact same words. You could transpose sentences from Brendan's interrogation and put them right in Chris Tapp's interrogation.
We are proud to give you all that we have.
Here, I'll take that. Our reward is that justice has been done.
I am at the mercy of the city of Idaho Falls and the prosecution to find the one and only killer of my daughter, lamented Carol Dodge, the mother of murder victim Angie Dodge. They need to do their job. Mrs. Dodge has done the job that the prosecutors and police in Idaho Falls and Bonneville County were not interested in doing because she is pursuing justice. They were pursuing a conviction. Having obtained a conviction, they will protect that conviction at the expense of justice, which is how Christopher Tapp wound up in prison, where he remains despite the fact that it is known to a moral certainty that he did not murder Angie Dodge. Tapp, I believe, was talent scouted by the presiding detective in the case, Jared Furman, because Furman had been a DARE officer and a resource officer at Idaho Falls High School, and he had known Tapp, and he knew that he was manipulable. 6 months after Dodge was murdered, January of 1997, a friend of Christopher Tapp by the name of Ben Hobbs was arrested for a rape in Ely, Nevada. And once the Idaho Falls police, who had not been able to make any headway on the case, in spite of the fact that they were aware of the man who almost certainly killed Angie Dodge, that's a subject about which I will have more to say in just a minute, they settled on Hobbs as a suspect, according to a report compiled by Judges for Justice. Once they had settled on him as a suspect, they stopped looking for suspects and worked to extract a confession. I think this has more to do with laziness and the bad incentive structure of government-operated law enforcement agencies than with some tenebrous conspiracy. I think that it was easier to wring a confession out of the suspects they had than it would be to invest the time to find the actual criminal. And they did this despite the fact, once again, that they had known about this much better suspect since the previous September. At about 3 a.m. on the morning of June 13th of 1996, Angie Dodge's neighbor, John Browning, received a visit from a fellow tenant at the Woodruff Apartments, which is located not that far from the scene of the murder. In an affidavit, Browning recounted that the visitor, who asked for a cigarette, had blood on his clothes, scratches on his face, and a rug burn on his chin. These are all stigmata, I believe, of a physical struggle with a woman who was taller than he was and weighed only 20 pounds less, and who was determined to protect herself. Browning wrote, I remember seeing tape on his wrists. Browning's ex-wife, Gentry, who was never interviewed by police investigators, later identified the man in a photograph that was taken in 1988. Browning was approached at work by a plainclothes police officer in September 1996 and gave him a detailed description of the blood-spattered late-night visitor. And this included the fact that he was often seen riding a black motorcycle with speakers attached by bungee cords, and Chris Tapp did not match that description. That was a match for a convicted rapist by the name of Jeffrey Lynn Smith. For reasons that have never been explained, the Idaho Falls Police Department decided not to pursue that lead. The reasons, I believe, are eminently explicable and legally indefensible for the fact that the Bonneville County DA's office withheld those facts from Tapp's defense attorney, thereby committing what is known as a Brady violation, that in and of itself was sufficient to vacate the conviction or at least to bring about a new trial. This was not made known to Christopher Tapp's defense attorney until after the conviction had been achieved. After Hobbs was arrested, he adamantly told the police that he had nothing to do with the killing of Angie Dodge. The available physical evidence eliminated Hobbs as a suspect, and so the Idaho Falls Police Department's theory expanded to include a second man named Jeremy Sargas, and eventually a third who was never identified. In the previous segment, I pointed out that there was no evidence at the crime scene to indicate that anybody other than a sole perpetrator had been involved in this heinous crime. Furman, in the course of his interrogation of Tapp, sought to elicit from him testimony that could be used against Hobbs and then Mr. Sargas, feeding him details about the murder and the crime scene, which, by the way, was made open to the public within a day of the murder. You're dealing with a contaminated crime scene, and you're dealing with the contamination of the memory of somebody who at this point was being treated as a witness. DNA tests disqualified both Hobbs and Sargas. So Furman, who at this point was probably acting under pressure from his superiors, and quite possibly, most likely, from his own ego, decided to frame Tapp for the crime. Tapp had been carefully beguiled into believing that he was helping the police learn the identity of this despicable creature who had murdered a friend. He was shocked and no doubt disoriented to learn that another friend was the likely perpetrator. That would be Mr. Hobbs. And he became terrified to discover that he could find himself in prison or facing execution for the crime unless he perjured himself. So the incentive structure dictated that he provide whatever his interrogators wanted to know or whatever his interrogators wanted him to say as a means of self-preservation. At first, he was offered immunity in exchange for testifying against Hobbs. That agreement was revoked by the prosecutor after the story that Furman had fed to Tapp was discredited by the actual investigation. He continued at this point, Mr. Tapp did, to deny any knowledge of or involvement in the murder, and this led Furman to escalate his demands. He was interrogated without the benefit of an attorney. After his mother intervened to obtain an attorney for him, the police arrested Tapp on a charge of accessory to a felony, and this was on the basis of the false narrative they had dictated to him. He was held for 6 days and then interrogated until he broke and gave them the spurious confession they had sought, after they had misled him into believing this was the only way he could avoid the gas chamber. The most sickening part of this process is where the emotionally battered suspect, who had been subjected to psychological torture, refused to admit the crime that he didn't commit, and Furman, who before becoming mayor was a prominent leader in the lay priesthood of the Mormon Church, invoked the concept of religious absolution by telling Tapp that he would receive some kind of divine favor if he agreed with the false narrative that was being imposed on him. Former FBI Special Agent McCrary, in his report to the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office, wrote, "This is a false confession." Furman and his colleagues manipulated Mr. Tapp through a series of explicit threats and promises, used false evidence ploys, asked a host of leading questions, and continually contaminated the interrogation by disclosing non-public details of the crime and crime scene while naming suspects speculatively, all of which is improper. These detectives never attempted to validate Mr. Tapp's repeated denials. The detectives had prematurely moved from an evidence-based investigation to a suspect-based investigation, with only mere speculation linking their favored suspects and crime scene. rather than seeking the truth, Furman and his subordinates displayed tunnel vision, confirmation bias, groupthink, organization momentum, and belief perseverance, thereby making them guilty of what Judges for Justice describes as noble cause corruption, the belief that the virtuous end of punishing a hideous crime justified the use of dishonest and criminal means, and as a result, they've stolen half of the life of an innocent man, and just as importantly, they let free the actual murderer of Angie Dodge, who, as I will point out in the next segment, was most likely the perpetrator in a double murder in 1992. I'll be back in just a minute.
I caught up with Chris Tapp's attorney here at the courthouse this morning just after that status conference. He told me they'll be testing things that haven't been tested before. One of those things is swabs taken of Angie Dodge's hands at the crime scene.
They did swab her hands with little Q-tips to see if there was DNA on it. Back in 1996, they didn't have the technology to test it. Now we have the technology.
Tapp's attorney says their argument is that Chris Tapp falsely confessed to the murder, and in that confession, Tapp said he was holding her hands down. The defense is hoping these swabs will show DNA from the killer and not Tapp. Other bits of DNA have been tested over the years in this case. So far, none of that has matched Chris Tapp's DNA.
Clothing and the teddy bear that was tested and everything that was tested as far as DNA goes, Christopher Tapp's DNA did not show up. There's no DNA from Chris. So all signs are pointing to a false confession rather than to Chris being at the scene of the crime.
In ancient Israel, the crime of man-stealing, which is now called kidnapping, was a capital offense. If you put somebody in prison who is innocent of a crime, that's man-stealing. So if we were to apply that standard, the state of Idaho, in the persons of Kip Manwaring, the prosecutor in Bonneville County, and Jared Furman, the lead investigator at the Idaho Falls Police Department, and his colleagues, and I suppose the jury, they all committed a capital crime by putting Chris Tapp in prison in spite of the fact that he was innocent of the horrible sex assault and murder on 18-year-old Angie Dodge. That crime is compounded by the fact that the entire criminal justice system of the state of Idaho has allowed Angie Dodge's actual murderer to remain at large. He had been seen wearing bloody clothes, displaying evidence of a physical struggle within a few hours of the June 13, 1996 murder. He was identified by at least one witness, and most likely two others, as Jeffrey Lynn Smith, a violent sex offender whose name was known to the Idaho Falls Police Department. He had been convicted of rape. He was on probation. After the conviction of his brother and after the conviction of Chris Tapp, he would go on to serve a couple of years in prison for probation violations. There's compelling evidence that Jeffrey Smith had committed a double murder in nearby Ammon, Idaho, 4 years prior to the killing of Angie Dodge. He had been identified as a suspect in that killing, and there was physical evidence, including a confirmed blood stain on his clothing, that linked him to it. For whatever reason, the police and DA's office chose to focus on his brother instead. He was convicted of the murder with the help of Jeffrey's testimony under a grant of immunity, and that of a jailhouse informant named James Swagger Jr. Unlike Lanny Smith, Mr. Swagger had a lengthy criminal resume that included several acts of burglary and accusations of sexual misconduct with a child. He spent a few years living in subsidized confinement here in Idaho before relocating to Marion County, Oregon, where he was convicted on June 20th of this year of theft and methamphetamine possession. The prosecution wants us to believe that Lanny Smith, during pretrial detention, confided to Swagger that he, and not his violent, criminally inclined brother who had once stolen his rifle and attempted to pawn it, murdered his neighbors Leo and Mary Downard in March of 1992. Lanny Smith was convicted of first-degree murder on April 18th of 1998, a little less than 2 months before Jeffrey Smith was seen in blood-stained clothes just a couple of doors down from Angie Dodge's home within a couple of hours of the murder. Shortly after Smith was convicted, the attorney representing him on appeal received a written statement from a woman named Jamie Lynn Hill, who testified that she had witnessed a fight between Jeff Smith and his ex-wife. During that fight, according to Hill's testimony, she was directly threatened by Smith when she tried to intervene. Quote, "You better back down, little girl, or I'll take care of you just like I took care of that old Ammon couple." Or, as you phrased the threat during testimony in Lanny Smith's post-conviction hearing, "I will put you down like I did the Donards." A report of an incident of spousal abuse between Jeff Smith and his ex-wife was filed with the Bonneville County Sheriff's Office on March 18th of 1994. According to Hill, Smith had come to the Life Care Center, which is a rest home where she and his ex-wife were employed, to demand money. He was in the company of what appeared to be two underage girls. About 7 months earlier, remember, he had been charged with rape, and he had been required to register as a suspected sex offender. He pleaded guilty to that offense on November 4th of 1993. At the time of his confrontation with his ex-wife, Smith was about a week away from a sentencing hearing that would result in an 8-year term of probation. He had legal and court fees to pay, and he needed money. It is reasonable to assume that his case was in the news. Hill testified that after being threatened by Jeff Smith, she recounted the incident to her father, Idaho Falls Police Captain Gary Hagan, who is, I believe, currently an instructor at the Peace Officer Standards and Training Academy in Meridian. During testimony in Lanny Smith's post-conviction hearing, Captain Hagan equivocated about the date of his daughter's disclosure, which he said was tied to a preliminary hearing. This was depicted as a reference to Lanny Smith's trial in 1996. However, it almost certainly referred to Jeffrey Smith's sentencing hearing, which happened 6 days after he had threatened to murder Hill. The prosecutor withheld that testimony from Lanny Smith's defense attorney until after he had been convicted. Just this past March, U.S. District Judge Edward Lodge ruled that this was not a Brady violation, which is to say, this is not a due process offense in which the prosecution withholds critical evidence from the defense. Lodge ruled that this was because there was no evidence that Gary Hagan was acting on the government's behalf in the Downard case. As an Idaho Falls police officer, he was not involved in the investigation of the Downard's homicides in Ammon, which were being investigated by the Bonneville County Sheriff's Department. More generally, he was acting as Hill's father rather than a law enforcement official when he advised her to contact the appropriate authorities and stay away from Jeff Smith. In addition, the argument that this was a Brady violation fails because petitioner, that is, Lanny Smith, has not proven that the timing of the statements was prior to the petitioner's trial. The problem here is that the prosecution was aware of this evidence, and it withheld it from the defense. And it doesn't matter whether or not Hagan was acting as a state official. This is evidence that is germane to the question of reasonable doubt. If this had been provided in timely fashion to Lanny Smith's defense counsel, it's entirely likely that they would have been able to dispel any ambiguities about the timeline, most likely associating that disclosure with Jeffrey Smith's sentencing hearing in 1994, rather than any of the preliminary hearings having to do with Lanny Smith's murder trial. During the trial, Jeff Smith, once again testifying under a grant of immunity, claimed that he had a fair reputation in the community. On cross-examination, however, the defense counsel wrung from him an admission that he had stolen the murder weapon, Lanny Smith's .22 caliber rifle, 5 years prior to the murder, and attempted to pawn it. He admitted to burglarizing the Smith family's home on several occasions. He admitted that on one prior occasion, he had kidnapped his ex-wife, driving her into the desert and threatening to murder her. Evidence was also presented that as a 16-year-old, Jeff Smith had brandished a firearm at a neighbor, and that a few years later, he had raped his first wife. This is the same ex-wife he subsequently assaulted in March of 1994 during the incident in which he threatened to murder Julie Hill. It should also be recalled that he was on probation for rape at the time of Lanny Smith's murder trial. For reasons that evade the understanding of rational people, that witness was given immunity and his testimony was deemed credible by the jury. Lanny was convicted of murdering the Downards on April 18th of 1996. 2 months later, almost to the day, Angie Dodge was murdered in what appeared to be an unsuccessful rape attempt. On the same evening of the murder, Jeff Smith materialized at the home of one of Dodge's neighbors covered in blood and displaying what could only be described as the signs of a physical altercation. Dodge, as it happens, was taller than he is and weighed only 20 pounds less than he did at the time. The assailant left behind hair and skin samples as well as semen, which suggests that the victim fought back. The IFPD knew of those witness reports and disregarded them in their effort to extract a confession, first from Ben Hobbs, who was suspected of a rape in Ely, Nevada, and then Christopher Tapp, who was pressured into implicating Hobbs. Once the DNA evidence excluded Hobbs and Tapp, the latter was convicted by a jury in the most authoritarian section of the state of Idaho. Just within the last couple of months, I've had a conversation with a defense attorney from Idaho Falls who lamented that if you take a case to trial in southeastern Idaho for reasons that are rooted in the Mormon culture of southeastern Idaho, the jury pool is likely to be entirely prejudiced against the defendant and in favor of the constituted authorities. It's almost impossible, in the opinion of this veteran defense attorney, who is a transplant from California, it's almost impossible to get a jury in that part of the state to understand that their job as jurors is to be biased against the state and against its constituted authorities. The state has to overcome that bias. It's called the presumption of innocence. In our system, the defendant is not required to prove his innocence. The state is required to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. As it happens, Chris Tapp and his advocates have proven his innocence. Lanny Smith most likely would have been able to prove his innocence as well if the prosecution had not withheld critical evidence that would have created a preponderance of reasonable doubt on his behalf during his trial. If they had prosecuted the actual killer of the Downards, who almost certainly was Lanny Smith's miscreant brother, Jeffrey, Angie Dodge would most likely be alive today. People in authority in Bonneville County and in the state of Idaho's justice system, such as it is, still profess to be mystified over the identity and location of Angie Dodge's killer. I can tell you exactly how to find him. Start at the police headquarters at 220 Freedom Way in the town of Radcliffe, Kentucky. Go to the end of the parking lot, then turn left on West Lincoln Trail Boulevard, drive about 2,000 feet to Highway 31 West, take a right, then drive about 1.9 miles, then turn left on South Street, proceed a little less than 500 feet, take another left, followed by an immediate right. You will then arrive at your destination, 58 Center Street, the most recent address of the actual murderer of Angie Dodge and Leo and Mary Downard, Jeffrey Lynn Smith. Mr. Smith, you murdered these people. If you take offense at me for identifying you as their murderer, please sue me. I will put you on the stand and I will ask you about everything I have discussed during this program, on the record. Please, Mr. Smith, sue me. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I will be back with you again in a week, and until then, as always, doom spirit of pugno while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state and its supposed justice system back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.